Not live and almost from Beverly Hills, it's the Bob Dean Show. Yay! I want to welcome everybody to, I believe this is episode 38. And we are, this is going to be flying by the seat of our pants, episode two per se. Our first episode was called Flying by the Seat of Our Pants. This one is our first videoed. Hi everybody, it's me, Bob Dean, that's what I look like. And this is Louis LaCava and Dennis Olson. My producer, Sammy Junio, hi Sam, is behind camera. So just bear with us, y'all, because this is our first episode on cam. And we're just going to act like y'all aren't out there in podcast land. Welcome, fellas. Before Hello. We get started with this is Louis. Say hi, Louis.
Hello, Louis.
And Dennis Olson.
Hello, Dennis.
And want to say shout out to Nicole Summerfield, our 405-inch traffic reporter. We started recording earlier today, so Nicole will be with us next episode. Want to say hi to Zach Herndon. Hi, Zach, out there in Bloomington, Indiana. Who Zach is one of the original backbones of the Bob Dean Show. Yay. And he does technical work for us from his palatial in Bloomington, Indiana home. So anyway, I'm so excited. We're on camera. Yay. First of all, I'm going to say a couple of things. I will be appearing at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood on Monday, March 12th, 7:45 showtime. Be there or be square. Because I'm reasonably amusing. I'm a much better comic than I'm a bartender. You can visit me at Wolfgang Steakhouse by Wolfgang's Wiener Wednesday through Saturdays for your viewing pleasure as well. And any other announcements we need to make? I'm just excited because this is our first one on camera.
I'd like to say something about last week. Last week I said that Joan Jett was in with the in crowd back then, but that's kind of fake because she's always in with the in crowd. And I said that her house was three blocks down from the whiskey, but it was actually more like three doors from the back of the gas station, across from the parking lot behind Licorice Pizza. So if I'm going to talk, I better say the truth.
That's right. Thank you, Dennis. And we're also going to get into a series of punk rock episodes, because I think it's fascinating. I'm starting to network with some really cool people, and we're going to talk about some really cool stuff that's led to a lot of really uncool people that think that they're punk rockers, but they're not. No names mentioned. No
poser
names.
Neighbors.
Posers. Posers. Okay, anyway. So Louis LaCava. Hey, Louis. Yay. Nice to be here. Louis, you live down in San Pedro now?
Yeah.
That's where your residence is, but you've lived all over the United States.
Yes. Lived in Utah, Missouri, upstate New York, Kansas for a long time.
And what about other countries?
Japan.
All right.
Japan. What'd you do in Japan?
I was teaching English.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How cool is that? I have a friend who from Fort Lauderdale who taught, she moved to Rome and taught English in Rome.
Very nice.
But were you learning Japanese?
Ego oshieta. No, I used to be fluent in it. I am not now, okay. So it's all broken. So.
My brother Trevor. Hi, Greg. Greg Dean. You better be listening to the Bob Dean Show. Yay. On your international travels back and forth to Asia. My brother Greg spends a lot of time in Asia now. Ching-ha. Yes, I said it. Okay. Really,
this is stopping it.
This is just neat because we're on video, and honestly, this is kind of neat. So, let's see. You've lived all over the country. What's your favorite place you've lived?
Oh, really? Ultimately, I mean, every place has a lot of good things going for it, really. But you know, once you're a South Bay LA guy, that's kind of it. But I like, there's a lots of things that I liked about Kansas. I did like the weather, the changing leaves and fall, huge thunderstorms, snow.
Change of season.
And get out, you could leave Wichita, Kansas, and 20 minutes you'd be out on the farm to market dirt roads that haven't changed since 100 years, you know. And I really enjoy just driving those roads and finding old barns and abandoned homes.
I love abandoned homes. If Walls Could Talk is my ultimate science fiction fantasy. And when I was growing up in Nashville, which is just, just bulldozed to death now. Sorry if I'm offending anybody there. But at the time, the area of town where we originally lived, it was had been farm country that was just starting to be developed. And there were a lot of... not a lot, but a few that it was the craziest thing. It's like an old car in the garage and the house was still furnished and things right. Like maybe it's some, you know, somebody died and the family was just like, you know, it's still on property they owned or whatever and just didn't want to deal with it. I love kicking around and stuff like that.
Yeah, I usually didn't take anything from places like that, but the clothes would be there and the dishes and the sink and everything.
Yep.
I did take a bat from one place, but that's about it. So.
Well, that reminds me of a story, which I probably have told before, but it's fascinating. It was Manuel Noriega. Had, I think it was him. He was the general that was doing all the drugs and all that.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. He had, I think it was him. So the story is what what I'm going for about abandoned homes and stuff. It was an island. There's three islands that going onto Miami Beach. And one of them, I think, is there's Star Island, and that's where Al Capone had a home as well. And we're going to get into a lot of that stuff here in the upcoming.
He purchased that in 27.
Oh, you know that, right?
Yes.
No, okay, great. Okay,
the Palm Island Estate, yes.
Okay, there's Palm Island, Star Island, and what they are these man-made islands that were established in the 20s and with these gorgeous mansions that were built around the waterside part. And I mean, they're small islands, and they're really, really, really cool. But Noriega, okay, there were also a couple of little apartment buildings, and my friends Claire and Stewart lived in one of the apartment buildings, and she's like, "You got to come over here right away." This house that I guess when he fled the country with his family, the house had been sitting, you know, sitting as they left it, but they started to tear it down, and they were tearing it down with everything in it, and they started out with the east wall of Manuel Noriega's Miami Beach mansion had been torn down, and it was like a dollhouse, a real dollhouse, because the wall was gone, the sun was shining into it, and it was amazing. The rooms were furnished, the clothes were hanging, you know, blah, blah, blah. I did take a letter, but I don't know what happened to it. But yeah, that's the fascinating stuff. But isn't it really? It's cool as shit when you know you get to walk around. And I didn't feel like I was traipsing on somebody's personal stuff because they abandon it.
Exactly.
You know, there've been like there's a couple houses in the neighborhood that they're gentrifying in my neighborhood, and there's been this one where this a very curious man lived on the corner, and he I've lived on the block for 13 years. He apparently passed away, and from the inside of his home. It looked like he probably just went to the hospital by himself and passed because they started to tear it down. So the doors and all that were off, but you walk inside and the books were still on the shelves and the family pictures still on the mantle. Yeah. It was heartbreaking, but that's where I got the joy.
They were just going to trash all that stuff?
Well, there's nobody. That's why, I honestly have gotten to the point where, Dennis, don't worry about it.
Okay. That can be edited out, so don't worry.
You know what's going to be edited out of this show? You, if you don't keep your trap shut.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You know, I'm just kidding. But you're taking me off. You're taking me off balance of all the interesting things I want to share with our friends.
All right.
What the hell is it now? I want to know. What's ringing?
It is weird. I shut my.
I've heard it like three times. No, it sounds like
No, mine's shut down.
It sounds like. Oh my gosh, maybe it's a ghost here. We can't talk about what one of our past guests played for us.
It's the sound of a phone turning on or off.
Yeah, it is. And see, we are sworn to secrecy on what a guest here on the in the past played us, and it we can't mention any names, but we can say that it was a true voice from the grave.
Wow.
And it'll scare the crap out of you, but we can't say who. We just can't. And how it came about.
Getting on track with the abandoned homes thing, although Capone's old home in Palm Island isn't abandoned, but I think there were security issues, and that's why he purchased there. So on the island, there's one way on.
One way on, one way off, and it's guard-gated all the time.
And you have a dock of your own. You can get out in a boat if you need to.
Yep.
So
wow.
That's what they were down there for.
Yeah.
And what a time to live down there, too.
I know. Wasn't it perfect?
Well,
your white linen Palm Beach suits and Panama straw hats.
Not anymore, honey. All right, so you are a self-proclaimed punk rock gypsy.
Sure.
Meaning that's where you've lived all around and done all kinds of different things. And
I'll own
it. What a cool, unusual life, man.
It's been kind of like being an eight ball, getting knocked around a table. Yeah, so.
That's neat. I thought I'd lived in Miami for years and now out here. So as continental as I appear, I'm not very well traveled. But seriously, even if it's domestically, that's awesome. You know, learning so much about the country and different spots and all that.
Gives you a different viewpoint.
Well, what we're going to do, since you and Dennis are punk rockers,
hello,
real punk rockers, and there is such a thing as existing real punk rockers, I think there it goes again. Did you hear it?
It's a ghost phone.
The ghost phone.
Seriously, did you hear it that time?
Is it that thing?
No.
Well, anyway, maybe we have a ghost here on the Bob Dean Show. Yeah.
Welcome. All are welcome.
All are welcome on the show. Come, children, come. All are welcome. Okay, but I think we're gonna work ourselves into a series of upcoming months punk rock shows, because it's friggin' fascinating.
I would love that.
And Dennis can tell you the story about. Did he tell you about Darby Crash's house right around the corner?
Oh yeah, we've been there together.
Oh, that's right. You took him over there.
I went to Darby's grave the first time Reggie was ever at his grave. Now I call Dennis Reggie, just so everybody knows. So,
would you prefer us to call you Reggie?
I don't either.
Reggie Mental.
Reggie Mental is Dennis's punk rock.
That was his name 38 years ago.
Well, it still is to most of your friends, right?
Yeah, I'm a dinosaur.
Well, but that is so, the 6 degrees of separation, it's so friggin' awesome in that one. And we'll talk about that on another episode of the Bob Dean Show. Yeah. Okay, now, first of all, why don't you take off your hat, if I might ask. Look at that. Look at that. We got it.
Baba Booey.
Not only is he a punk rocker, but he's a friggin' gangster.
Gangster.
For real. Now, gangster, this episode we're going to talk about your gangster life.
Not like the lads or anything, but still.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're talking vintage gangster.
Right.
What are the lads? Are they like real gangsters now or something?
Well, it was the Death Squad, the LA Death Squad.
Of a modern thing.
In 1980.
Yeah.
Some of the local LA punk guys, Hollywood punks primarily, organized and it was to protect the scene. There's a lot of new people coming in, just hitting anybody they wanted. And
you told me about that, like people come, like kids coming in that thought they were punks and wanted, just causing trouble and that sort of thing.
And these guys tried to regulate some of that. It was like
the shit they saw in the media, they took as real violence when it was punk violence.
Yeah, the media is really where all the violence came from. They literally
LA Weekly.
Oh, the media fucks up everything. But it's things like, even like Kent State, that, you know, all those protests in the 60s and stuff like that. You know, people were peacefully protesting and as the way we should, but then they'd get the media would get in there and rouse somebody up, pay somebody to get in there and start the trouble so they could have something to film.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's definitely.
Anyway. So we're gonna touch on that too. I want to talk about happy stuff. No, well, happy gangster stuff.
Happy gangster.
So okay, so seriously, like happy Valentine's I don't know where to start. Day. We were talking earlier, and there's just too many cool ways to go. You said in 1974. How old are you? I may ask.
Well, I never. Well, tell you don't. I'm 55.
Okay. Well, we're the same. You know, we're all that same age group.
We're the
same. In 1974, you said you saw the movie Bugsy Malone.
Yes.
And that's what inspired, and it's an all-kids gangster film.
Yes, most people wouldn't know that. It comes out of England. It's big in England still as a play. All these schools do the play. Of course, it involves kind of faux machine guns and things, which our schools might, you know, flip out about. But excellent production values, as the English always have when they're covering the past. And it starred Scott Baio, and... It was the story of Fat Sam and his fight with Dapper Dan and the two gangs, and then of course Bugsy Malone saves the day and gets the girl in the end. So he wore exactly this hair in the movie, and it inspired me. I mean, that was it. You know, I just immediately identified with candlestick phones, old cars, the old kinds of sinks in your bathroom or whatever it may be.
Clawfoot tubs and black and white checkered tile in bathrooms. Yeah, it's awesome.
Exactly.
So continue. You have been researching, you have favorites. Tell us some of the things you've learned about some of your favorite gangsters.
There's interesting things about various ones. Al Capone was soft-spoken. Al Capone kept his word. That doesn't mean he was necessarily less violent or anything, but he is not, as portrayed in the movies, a loud, obnoxious bore who's saying, "I'm going to take over the whole city." See,
listen,
doesn't exist. Al Capone's boss, Al Capone. They don't know for sure, but he goes to Chicago from New York after killing a guy in New York to work for Johnny Torrio. Johnny Torrio worked for. Another guy, Big Jim Colosimo, right when Prohibition is starting. And it's generally assumed, although it's never been proven, Johnny Torrio kills Big Jim Colosimo and takes over the Southside bootlegging operations because Big Jim didn't want to get into booze, and Torrio saw what kind of money you were going to make in booze.
Now, as far as like organized gangs, you know, they were in all cities, right? But what I don't know, really know why Chicago was the one that was focused in, as far as the 30s Al Capone gangsters, you know. Where the same sort of things were going on in New York and Miami and Los Angeles.
Very true. Yeah.
But what do you think it was, the reason why Chicago was had such an influence on the stories and the gangsters that we seem to know by, you know, on the forefront?
Awesome question. And personally, I think it does boil down to Capone. He becomes the figurehead for Chicago gangsterism, although you know, there's like 20 gangs out there. I mean, Martin Guilfoyle and the South Side O'Donnells, the West Side O'Donnells. There's a million of them. The movies only focus on the North Siders with Dion O'Banion in a conflict with Capone. But there's a bunch of gangs. But Capone survived and prospered. Extremely smart guy. And he had a great tutor in Johnny Torrio, whose motto was, "We don't want no trouble." So you'd rather pay somebody off or have a cop move to the countryside rather than kill somebody. And that leads to a lot of success. And Capone was very, in general, pretty precision about killing people. You know, he's killing a big guy. It's a very intricate plot to get him. And, bystanders aren't killed and that kind of thing. Just to give an example, in like, I believe it was 27, the Northsiders did a drive-by shooting on the Hawthorne Hotel, where Capone had headquarters set up at the time. That Hawthorne Hotel was in Cicero. And it's like the number of cars grows over the years, but it was something like 4 to 6 cars in procession firing at this restaurant where Capone was eating, with other people eating in there and everything. And the only person hit was a woman in a car out front, and had a fragment of glass go in her eye, and Capone paid all her medical bills, by the way. But
with an ambush like that, nobody else was hurt?
No, everybody hit the floor.
How crazy.
Yeah, well,
thank God, you know.
Yeah, really. That's not always the case with this kind of thing. But then, you know, Capone turns around and knocks off Jaime Weiss. Jaime Weiss was running the Northsider gang out of Schofield's flower shop on North State Street. So Capone rents an apartment 2 doors up, and on the cross street also another apartment that looks down the alley. So he's looking. Anyway, these guys get back from court one day, and they're crossing the street, and there's a shotgun.
But no, he had a visual from both apartments. Yeah. Directly. Yeah, yeah.
He got a Thompson submachine gun, which jammed after 30 rounds, and a pump shotgun up there, and they hit everybody and killed Jaime Weiss dead. And I mean, really dead. If you see the pictures, there's a bullet hole in his head, and, you know, over his eye and all this stuff. And they got who they wanted without collateral damage, as we would call it in Iraq today or whatever, you know? Man. And so that was the difference between like kind of wild, angry, undisciplined cowboy gangsters and what Capone was doing, which was much really trying to be more professional in killing and making money and that kind of thing. You know?
Did he
more
now
responsible?
Yeah,
for his actions.
I mean, really, for what it's worth, at least, you know. Yeah, yeah. Now he was arrested they got him on tax evasion, and he died in prison.
No, he's released and it's kind of interesting. He's released in 39, I believe it is, and he's released from Alcatraz, and he goes down to San Pedro. He's at the federal facility on Terminal Island, where he meets his family. They take him to the... So we have a little Capone connection here in L.A. Then he goes to the Northeast to be treated for syphilis, which I think they call it tertiary, but it had gone into his brain, which like only 1% of people with syphilis get that kind. And he didn't have any luck on that one. But so his family took him to see doctors. And that's why he was released early, actually, was because of he had recurring spells of dementia. And he had spent the last year in Alcatraz in the medical ward in a cage and in and out of his mind at certain times. And then
Wow, that's fascinating. I mean, yeah, because you think, yeah, I heard, you know, learn that he died of syphilis, but you don't think about the background, you know, the details,
right,
of how that happened, right, or what happened, the circumstances that continue to grow and all that. That's wow.
And he ends up dying in 47 at the Palm Island Estate in the guest house behind the pool.
Didn't you go to his house?
I have been to Al Capone's Chicago home on South Prairie, which was a real honor and a lot of luck. And
how did that come about?
Well, I'd been to Chicago several times by myself, but this time I went with two friends, and we were all dressed like I am today with fedoras and overcoats and everything. And we're in
which
front
is very cool.
Thank you. And we're in front of Capone's house, and we're comparing the house to pictures from the 20s in books. And these two guys come down the street and, hey man, what you doing? And we said, we're looking at Al Capone's house. They go, no, you're not looking at Al Capone's house. We said, we're looking at Al Capone's house. And they said, do you think these people know they live in Al Capone's house? We said, yes, 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 don't bother them, you know?
Yeah.
But they went right up to the door and knocked. And this big guy named, I believe his name was Jason, came out. And we talked to him for a bit. And then he said, just let these guys go on and I'll take you through the house. And, you know, he didn't ask for any money or anything, but we paid him because, you know, he gets bothered. While we were there, people from Spain showed up to look at the house.
No kidding.
People from other parts of the country came.
Wow. Yeah. And how touching.
Yeah.
For him to what,
It's like 7244 South Prairie, if I have the address right, whatever, for all of you who want to go visit it.
I know. Yeah. For now, for everybody that wants to go knock on the door. I got chased down Loretta Lynn's driveway by a German Shepherd, by the way. So was it like a Victorian style? Was it, you know?
Good question.
Was it
it's
a
what
big
they call
house?
A prairie style house. It's essentially a duplex, one over the other. It's very narrow, like a shotgun. It goes from the front of the lot to the back. So you walk up the stairs to the front, you open a big door, and inside there's a little entryway, and there's
foyer
stairs
entryway
on the right that go up to the upstairs where Capone's brother Ralph supposedly lived for a while. And on the left, there's a door, and it goes into Al Capone's house. And so you go through that door, it takes a slight right curve off your left, is the living room where Al Capone's brother in April of 1924 laid in his coffin while they had a wake for him in the house. Wow. And then off to the right is a bedroom. As you go down the hallway, there's a bathroom. You continue down the hallway. On each side of you, there's two more bedrooms, one to the left, one to the right. Then you enter into the dining room. Off the dining room to the right is the kitchen, and the kitchen opens onto like a balcony on the back, but it's stairs. You can go up and down all three levels, all two levels of the house. And there's apparently, although I didn't see it, there's like a servant staircase from the kitchen up to the upstairs.
So it would have been considered like a pretty grand place. I mean, I'm sure, you know, as far as like size and that sort of thing, if you throw servants into the equation.
Yeah, I don't think he had servants, but
but I mean, the home must be large and beautiful.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's got the living room window to the left and the door on the right.
Well, it's interesting that you walk through the bedrooms and all that to get to like the kitchen and dining room. Right?
Yeah. Well, you walk down a hall that passed them as you went.
Right. So not through them literally, but you know.
And you know, there's stories. It's fun to see this in your head while you're in the house. Al Capone's. You're thinking of in 1924 when his brother was killed on election day by police. Because he was beating up people to make sure they voted the right way. And he laid in his coffin in that living room. And then also there's the time the reporters showed up at his house. And Al Capone answered the door, you know, with his shirt and tie and suit pants on, but with a robe. And he's stirring a pot of marinara. He's making red sauce for dinner. And he invites them in, and they all have a nice time, you know. So, you know. And that's when he talked about how he couldn't even sit in his own living room window without pulling the curtain shut because somebody would, you know, shoot through the windows.
Right. Well, let's go on to another. How about Bonnie and Clyde?
Bonnie and Clyde. Well, there's a Bonnie and Clyde festival in Gibbsland, Louisiana, which is like northwest Louisiana. It's a little nothing burg of a town, which has actually gotten smaller over the years. They used to have a theater and a thriving business district.
Till the interstate came through.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? You know, and it's just wrecked now. And but 9 miles south of Gibbsland, Louisiana, in May of 1934, Bonnie and Clyde headed south of town about 9 miles and were caught in an ambush and killed. And so I've been fortunate enough to be, I have gone to the gas station, the Barrow gas station that's on West Dallas. I've been to their graves. A guy who ran with them by the name of Raymond Hamilton, who was put in the electric chair, actually. His birthday and mine are the same day, May 21st. But I've been in that festival several times, and I actually got to play Clyde Barrow a couple years. And 1 year we had a 34 Ford like they were killed in that was restored specifically to be like that. So it was really interesting to hear those same engine sounds and everything, the car sounds you would hear heading down that road where you know they actually were killed. So
so they came out of, what's the name of the town again?
Gibbsland.
Gibbsland. Mm-hmm. And that's where their ultimate demise came from, 9 miles out of. So their last, what is that? Interaction with a town. Did they do any? Did they rob anything? In
good question. They were hanging out there. They were out of Texas. They had a supposed friend by the name of Henry Methvin, and they had sprung him from jail. And they were hanging out in the area. They wanted to stay there. The rumor is that Clyde had saved up enough money to buy some property there, which really wasn't a smart idea. The only thing that kept him alive so long is constantly moving. Mm. And they did what I call deep cover. You know, Babyface Nelson, when he went undercover, they went to Buffalo, New York and rented an apartment. What Bonnie and Clyde would do in deep cover is they would drive for 9 hours a day or more and then pull off in a field, pull the seats out of the car and sleep on that, put them back in and go again. That's what really kept them alive. So the idea of buying a piece of property in Gibbsland, Louisiana was no good. Well, Henry Methvin was wanted for various crimes and his father, Ivy Methvin, made a deal with the Texas law enforcement, and it's a dirty deal all around. Clyde Barrow had purchased a truck for Ivy Methvin so that he could have work.
But not using his name, though, right?
No. Yeah. He gave him the money, and Ivy Methvin purchased the truck. Well, that truck was the bait used. They parked that truck 9 miles south of Gibbsland, Louisiana, with a tire off it, like it had a flat. And here comes Clyde Barrow, and he knows that truck, and he knows Ivy Methvin.
Oh, man.
And they had parked it in Clyde's lane. If you're down there, to the right of the road as you're going south, the route Bonnie and Clyde took, to the right it goes downhill, but to the left it goes uphill. And the cops were hiding in the bushes on the left. So they put the car in the right lane and drove Clyde. When Clyde stopped, he had to pull right to the left up against this embankment. And he's looking at Ivy Methvin to his right, and the cops are to the left.
Was Ivy with the truck or just?
Yes, he was with the truck. And they made up stories later that he did it against his will and was tired. Well, that was just so that no Barrows or Parkers came and killed him later. But really, he participated fully. He was leaning in the passenger window, talking to Bonnie and Clyde, and one of the cops lets loose the first shot, takes Clyde just above and behind his left ear, and he's dead instantly, falls against the steering wheel. All the cops unload with shotguns and fully automatic weapons, and Clyde's foot comes off the clutch, so now the car's going down the road, and they think he's getting away again. And they keep shooting and shooting. And
so he was taken out with the first shot.
With the first shot.
I wonder what shot took Bonnie. I mean, I wonder if she had took, you know,
if you read the autopsies, there's so many bullet tracks through her, it's beyond belief. In fact, her right hand is almost severed from her body, and one of her fingers is completely shot up in the palm area, and another is shot off at the middle knuckle. I mean, we're talking the amount of firepower through this car was amazing. There was no chance. There was also no warning given. Not like, throw your hands up, Clyde Barrow, we're going to take you alive. No, we're killing you.
Well, did Ivy get killed too?
No, Ivy. No, he.
Because if they started firing like that, did he know to to roll and?
He dove under the truck, and he apparently later said that first shot nearly took my head off. Because his head is in the passenger window.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
Yeah. So he dove under his own truck that was purchased for him as a nice gift by Clyde Barrow, who he was then working to set up for death. So.
Wow. I wonder if his son got that. Did his son have any benefits if he was broken out too?
They had made a deal.
A deal.
That's they had made a deal that if he stayed in that area, he was okay. And Texas law enforcement later was able to lure him out and arrest him. They arrested him in Texas on whatever. At any rate, years later, and the Barrows and Parkers and Methvins, there's a bunch of them still around, by the way, still think that. Methvin was offed. He was the standard story is that he was drunk and fell asleep under a freight train, which then started up and ran him over and killed him. And others say he was placed there. So,
why do so many drunk people get killed on train tracks?
Seriously. I used to see it all the time when I grew up, because across the street from me was the railroad tracks, and across the street from that was all the bars in town. So drunks were constantly, I'm like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, getting hit, and we follow the guys picking up noses and
my
fingers and shit the next fucking day.
Well, that answers save my them? Question.
They just seem to fall out when the heavy gravity.
Did you save them?
The iron, no.
Maybe it has something to do with the iron and iron poor blood.
Well, if you trip on those railroad tracks, I had a very good friend. He was a Seneca Indian named... Sleepy Eye, actually was his name. And, he would drink a lot. We'd go out and have fun, and he tripped on the tracks and split his head open. So I think a lot of them trip on the tracks and split their head open. That's my thought.
That makes sense.
I can't get up.
They just trip. That's it. It's that simple.
Don't be tripping. Don't be tripping on the tracks, bitches. Don't be tripping on my tracks.
Just get off of my tracks.
I was sitting there. Well, that's not something about. That's a whole other story. Except this vagabond per se. I was sitting at when Nashville area was still kind of rural. There was a railroad track that didn't even have a bar that came down, and it was in the country out where we live, the country. And the freight train's going by really slow, and I'm like, drumming my fingers. I'm probably 16, just got my license. And this railroad car goes by, and there's this guy with no teeth. And he's waving like,
y'all got any vittles?
It was perfect.
And he did that for the entire 500 miles of the train trip, right?
Yeah.
But this, my friend's Kathy, Jetri Garcia, she had a house in this one part of town where the tracks came by, several yards back from her backyard. But the same cat came back like three times, I think it was twice, from Memphis. It had an ID tag. It was a Memphis number, and the cat kept jumping on the train near its owner's house and riding the train and jumping off at Kathy's house. It's like 300-plus miles, yeah.
Man, so they finally, hobo cat.
Yeah, Kathy got a hold of the owner the second time. The owner's like, just keep the cat.
Cat's calling the shots.
That's right. Okay, now back to Bonnie and Clyde. And now they – was. I know she – I was reading – I went on Wikipedia, and there's so much about them,
yes,
and pictures and all that. And I didn't realize it was going to be so much interesting material.
It's this unbelievable,
has,
isn't it?
A picture of the life change. They shot their way out of the Joplin hideout.
Oh,
have you seen this,
this
one?
Picture is this, you're looking at here. I have stayed three times in that building over
now. It's a garage with an apartment above.
Because
I'm assuming this would be a 1933 photograph.
This is another security issue. This is in Joplin, Missouri, which is in the far southwest portion of Missouri, as they say.
Missouri.
And the reason for that is, number one, the location is that you're close to Kansas and you're also close to Oklahoma, and it doesn't take long to get to Arkansas. So he's looking to cross state lines from that point if the cops show up, because at that time, local police were not allowed to follow you across a state line.
Right,
yeah.
Now, the thing to know is 2 or 3 days before they got this house, they had gotten another house to rent, which was wood. This house was chosen because there's also a garage in back of it, but this house is stone, and you're on the second floor. It's
obviously stone.
This was picked because it's a fortress.
And it stops bullets.
And it could hold all three of their cars. Just a little before this.
So it is an actual freestanding house, because in this the angle of this picture, it looks like a garage with an apartment over it.
Well, the first floor is a garage. It's a two-car garage, and in back of it, there's a one-car garage that belongs to another property, but that's where Clyde's brother Buck was keeping his Marmon. I think he bought a Marmon when he got out of prison with God knows where he got the money for that. But he had just gotten out of prison. He was with his wife, Blanche. And they met up with Clyde and Bonnie and W.D. Jones.
Right.
And also known as Deacon Jones, Dub Jones. And they had gone from one place.
And that was Gene Hackman in the movie, right?
Gene Hackman was Buck Barrow.
Okay, the brother. Movie. Okay.
And the funny-looking guy with the big cheeks in the movie, that was an amalgamation character. That was several real people put together, such as Henry Methvin and W.D. Jones. That was two people put together. So,
and look here, you just mentioned it. Just 16 years old, W.D. Jones committed two murders in his first 2 weeks as Clyde Barrow's protege. Wow.
He drank a lot.
Well, there's a bunch of pictures of them leaning against these really fantastic cars with guns and that sort of thing.
These are what they call the Joplin photos. So these pictures were captured after the shootout in Joplin.
Okay.
Where I believe two officers were killed.
Did you ever get to see the two-unit Red Crown tourist court?
That
location?
Was torn down many years ago, but I've been to a Bonnie and Clyde symposium there, and we've walked that property extensively and what all. You'll notice that is another property that is built of stone. It has connecting garages. So from your little bungalow, you could get into your garage.
Right.
So they came barely out in that one. And that's where Buck Barrow was mortally wounded at getting away from.
Right. And here's a picture here with Blanche being taken away. Now, didn't she get shot in the eye?
I believe really what it was glass fragments.
Mm-hmm.
She had glass fragments in her eye, but not like a bullet sailing through her head or anything. But now that's what Buck had happen. He had an actual bullet hole through his head.
Because Blanche served 6 years because she had never fired a gun.
But he lived for days. Infection finally took Buck in the hospital.
Well, let's talk. I want to hear about, we were talking earlier. Well, what time are we at?
40.
See? Flies by when you're having fun on the Bob Dean Show.
Yay!
Sammy Sloot. Yay. let's take a few minutes to talk about, because what you were talking. Well, the actors group where you because we're going to come back and talk about this on another show too. So we didn't hit. And I'm going to do more homework on it because this is fascinating. I've always been fascinated.
When you dig
it.
In, it's very
Yeah. But tell the listening and now viewing audience.
Hello, TV Land.
Hello, TV Land. I look so much. Is it really adding 10 pounds? If you tell me it does, I'll kick your. Anyway,
you look taller.
The acting group where you did the festival group.
Okay, it was a group started in the mid '80s. If I'm not mistaken, and it was back then, it was called DEOA, Depression Era Outlaw Association.
Is it still? Is the troupe still in?
Yes, they still exist.
Okay,
and they switched names at some point to Reenactments Etc., which means ETC stood for Early 30s Crime, and now we're called Public Enemies. So it's a bank robbery group that is hired by towns. They hire us to. Perform a bank robbery at their town festivals, and so
like the Hooterville Wheat Harvest Festival or 4th of July or something.
Hootersville, yes,
yeah,
that's it exactly. But excitingly, that's how we get into the Bonnie and Clyde Festival in Gibson, Louisiana, and also one of my favorites, Mason City, Iowa. You might say, what's in Mason City, Iowa? Well, John Dillinger robbed the First National Bank in Mason City, Iowa in like March 13th, 1934. And I got to play John Dillinger in that. And so we go to these towns, we get hotel rooms, we tow in vintage cars. I have a 31 Buick. I also have two 1930 Fords.
I cannot wait to see these.
Yeah.
Seriously.
And we other members have other cars too, other Fords and Chevys, and I can't even name them all. Whippets, Essex Terraplanes, which was Dillinger's favorite car, the 33 Terraplane, which had a straight eight engine in a very light car, so it was fast. And then, you know, we have the whole thing worked out. We have bank alarm bells rigged, and we have people playing civilians, as you might call them, you know, who get taken hostage during the show. And
that sounds fun.
Especially in Mason City, Iowa, we try to reenact their bank robbery, which happened, which is...
Was it the actual structure?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cool. How awesome is that?
I know, huh?
It's you know, somebody, we went and looked at it the night before we did the show, and my guy I knew said to me, you know, you'll be the first person to stand in that spot with a Thompson submachine gun since Dillinger 75 years ago.
Holy crap. You know, so, if walls could talk, man.
Yeah. Wow. So that was, you know, and I, you know, it's so rough to say because people are judgmental. They think, oh, you shouldn't break the laws or anything like that. Well, punk rock, sorry, laws get broken. John Dillinger was not a bad guy. He was only ever accused of killing one person in East Chicago. It was Officer O'Malley. The witnesses, if you read the actual witness accounts, are highly, what do you call it? They don't agree with each other.
Judgment.
So, yeah.
They don't agree with how they saw it?
Well, one person says this guy shot him. Then who they identify these people as being is all over the place. So there's, and it's also highly questionable if in winter of 1934, if Dillinger, they had spent New Year's in Florida, and I think Daytona Beach, and the house was just knocked down this year that they stayed in, by the way.
No, of course it's knocked down. Thank you, developers. Thank you, developers. We need more retail shopping and office malls. Space and strip malls. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
So, but they supposedly made it up all the way to East Chicago in like a matter of 2 days or something, which is... That's really pushing it.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a lot of luck to do it. I think maybe it is possible, but you'd have to have a lot of luck because bad roads, those cars broke down, you got lots of flats, things like that. You know, those roads were two-lane, wavy roads. They weren't like
they
our
weren't even what they weren't even what they were in the 40s and 50s.
No.
As far as like Route 66, but anyway.
Yeah, so he supposedly made it up there and in the course of the bank robbery killed this guy. But it really... So some people think he did
But in the course of that trip... He killed this guy, but they were outlaws then? Or were they wanted for bank robberies and that sort of thing before the unfortunate incident?
Yeah, he's only doing a short run, really, of bank robberies. He's released. He gets screwed over. This guy gets him drunk in his hometown, I believe it was Mooresville, and... gives him a lead pipe and wanted him to rob this store owner as he walked home. He would take the money home with him every day. And so that goes horribly wrong, and Dillinger gets arrested for it. And the authorities being what they are, which is to say dishonest, they advise Dillinger, as a young man, Dillinger, we'll go easy on you if you confess. What they didn't tell him was Indiana state law dictated that if you confess to this, you had to get the maximum sentence. So the guy who was with him, who was a full adult, he got off with like 5 years and he gets out in 3 or whatever. And Ed Shaw? No, that's not it. And Dillinger gets like a 10-year sentence. And while he's in there, his wife leaves him. His father never showed up to the sentencing or the preliminary hearings. His father never went to see him in prison, nothing like that. And at some point, I think Dillinger changes and he comes out and he's going to have a good time and he's going to take it out on society. So he goes robbing some low-level banks. He made friends with bank robbers in there. He networked. with professionals, real and this was a real profession at the time, not like it is nowadays. And he robbed and got enough money together, and he got guns smuggled in, and 10 guys broke out of prison, and he hooked up with them, and that's like what they call the first Dillinger gang, although... You know, the idea that he's actually running it, you know, these were cooperatives, right? So it's not like Hollywood where one guy says, we're going to do this and that's the way it's going to be. These people worked together and they had different jobs. I think you'd find that interesting. Everybody knows Wheelman for the gang. One of their Wheelman for the Dillinger gang actually drove race cars earlier in his life. You had what they called a center fielder. That was the guy that went into the bank and took over the lobby, made sure all the customers laid down and nothing happened. You had a guy called the Tiger who stood at the door, and he made sure nobody left, but he also took control of anybody coming in. Then you had...
Something I've always wondered about, especially in a situation like that. How would he discourage somebody from coming in?
You wouldn't discourage them. You let them get there, and then you grab them and don't let them go. And then you had guys who were called skimmers, and those were the guys who went behind the teller's cages and skimmed up all the money. They would usually, on a real bank job, they would usually identify the head teller first because he knew how to open the vault. You would grab that guy, hit him over the head to get his attention, you take him to the vault, and then you start cleaning the vault out. And you would try to be out of there very quickly. You would do the whole job in a car that was stolen for the purpose. You would ditch it 4 miles out of town, and you'd have other cars waiting you take off. You'd also have equipment, such as maybe you'd have bandages or morphine. You'd have corks, because if your gas tank got shot up, you'd stop and put a cork in it. You might have gas stashed along the route. You might have food stashed along the route. There's all kinds of things. They would make things called git maps. They would show up in a town a week, a month before a bank robbery, and they would have one guy drive the route, and another guy wrote down, not drawing a map, wrote down 3/4 from the T intersection, there's a stop sign, blah, blah, blah. And then as they were making their getaway, the guy in the passenger seat was reading these instructions. Okay, in a 1/4 mile, you're going to hit a T intersection. You want to take a left. Turn the page. You know, like that.
Fascinating.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
isn't
that crazy?
Fascinating stuff.
One thing I've always wanted is to contact the FBI, because I know they've hung on to some of those.
I know. I'd like to.
Oh, hell yeah.
To see an actual git map would be interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, I can tell that you really know your stuff, and we're just scraping the surface in this episode, because you get really passionate, just like I do when I'm talking about certain things.
Good.
Well, you catch something that you know you want to elaborate on, and you go, I do the same thing, right? And I break for like 3 seconds to gather my thought and follow with this is great. Because I know that we're running out of time. Are we not? Dang it. Time goes by so fast on the Bob Dean Show. Yay. Well, look, Louie, I want to say thanks, and we're definitely going to have you back. We're going to I want to dig in more about gangsters and, of course, punk rock. And
thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. First time I've ever done anything like this. So.
Well, it's fun, and we have a really good time, and I do, and I'm really excited to see how we look on. So this will be available on the same thing on iPhones.
Yep.
Like, will Zach be able to help me put this up on my website?
Oh yeah.
Zach,
Zach. I can't wait to get into the punk rock debauchery.
Oh, man, seriously, it's fascinating. It's really cool.
There's some really amazing shit in that.
Maybe someday we could even do, can we do it, a version where we're walking around?
Yeah, totally.
We could do a Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Somebody better be taking notes.
What are some crimes, popular crime sites in L.A.?
Well, okay, we're gonna write all that stuff down. That's great.
After the time period that I know, but there are...
But we could go.
Cohen was big here, and he was shot here, and all that.
Oh, well, listen. Whatchamacallit? I have a friend who used to bag. Who was the big
bodies?
One? No, groceries for the 50s gangster.
Mickey Cohen
that started,
is the 50s gangster.
Is it Mickey Cohen that lived in Brentwood? Bugsy Siegel. My friend, my friend Hector, who he and his lovely wife Carol had been together since 1960, whatever. He went to Uni High.
No way.
No
way.
The connection.
See? Where he 6 degrees of separation in this town,
yeah,
y'all.
It's amazing.
I have been to the house where Bugsy was killed. I haven't been in, but I've been to it.
Well, wow. Then you got to meet Hector. Well, he used to bag on the corner of Beverly Glen and Santa Monica, where there's a Walgreens now, of course. used to be a supermarket where Bugsy would shop, and Hector would bag his groceries because Hector lived over here in West LA where Darby lived. And it's just really, there's so much to talk about on the Bob Dean Show.
Yay!
And of course, you never called him Bugsy to his face.
Oh, we'll get into that on the next show. We got to go.
It's a crimopedia, man.
I think it's awesome. So anyway, remember, I'll be at the Laugh Factory on March 12th, Monday, 7:30 p.m. Everybody who's anybody will be there. In the meanwhile, is there anything else we need to touch on? Thank you so much, Sammy, for setting us up for video.
Yay, Sammy.
Yay.
That's a real one.
That's a real yay. And so we didn't take any pictures. Yeah, okay. I guess that's it. And we'll be back again next week. God bless. And next week, this guy that's going to be on next week, you're going to love him.
Oh, yeah.
It's not going to be you, but you'll be on soon. All right. I guess we're done. Thank you all very much.
Bye. Sayonara.
Bye. Sayonara. Aha.